Hello and welcome to the programme. Today we're going to be taking a trip down memory lane, bringing you highlights from the past few months here on Mooney Goes Wild. We'll be talking to Joe Freely from County Mayo, for whom not dogs but doves are a man's best friend. And fishery scientist Ken Whelan will join us later to reveal what we can learn from gazing into a fish's eye. But we start with a story from early summer, when I needed help from our panellists with a nuisance fly pestering me at my front door. In studio with me, Niall Hatch is here of Birdwatch Ireland and of Mooney Goes Wild, it has to be said. Niall, I'm fed up introducing you as Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland.
Well, I'll answer to anything you want to call me, but it's lovely to be back here looking at you in the eyes right here in the studio.
Yes, we haven't seen the panel for well over a year or so because of the COVID lockdown, but we're still respecting the social distancing. Niall is a measured 2 metres away from me. Aina's a lot further. She's in County Clare. Aina.
Hello, Derek. How are you doing? Yes, I am in County Clare. Wonderful place. I even had a swim in the sea today, Derek, in the real sea. Ooh. And I'm a living to tell the tale. I'm still alive.
Was it cold?
It was rather chilly. It was beyond cold. But, you know, it was, I think, about 11 degrees, the water. And outside, the temperature was about 14. So it was a toss-up which was colder outside or inside. But, you know, I have plenty of adipose tissue, my own central heating, as it were. So I was glad.
Anyway, let's get on with the programme. We'll talk to Richard Collins a little bit later on, and we'll be going to Terry Flanagan on the Royal Canal very shortly. But Aina and Niall, this is a great one. Now, I have noticed when the days have been warm that every time I open my front door, there's a fly waiting there to come in. I know you don't believe me, but it has been happening to me. Now, it didn't happen all this week because it has been raining pretty much every day. But the week before, I noticed this. So I'll let you hear the little recording. I get up. I walk down the stairs. Now, listen carefully to what happens. That's me going down the stairs. Now, needless to say, I put my clothes on. I've had a shower. Open the door. And in comes the fly.
Not again.
And I say, not again. So then I'm walking around the house trying to shoo this fly out the door.
Shoo.
And eventually I manage to get in such a position that the fly can't get past me. And it's gone back out the door. But my question is, Aina Ní Leabhar and Niall Hatch, what is that fly doing outside my house every morning on warm days? And how does it know I'm going to open the door? And why does it come in?
Oh, Derek, you have too much time on your hand. You definitely do. First of all, which way is your front door facing? Is it facing north, south, east or west? Or do you know?
Of course I don't know, Aina. No idea.
Oh, Derek, you're just desperate.
It's facing the front.
Well, I know it's facing the front of your house, but were it to be facing east, then the sun would be shining on your front door the days when it's warm, and therefore the front door would be warm. And that fly that came in is a bluebottle fly. It's not a house fly, it's a blowfly. And these flies are only looking, Derek, for two things. And they're looking for food and they're looking for heat. So they can either detect the heat or they can smell the food with their antennae and the hairs on their bodies. Now, I suppose your house is fairly clean and isn't full of smelly,
indeed,
awful things that the blowfly wants to lay its eggs in. So I would say this fly is on your front door. It may not be the same fly every day. You don't know whether it's the same one or whether it's a different one. But flies like warm places. We'll assume your door is facing east. You can find this out yourself. It's been warmed by the sun. The fly is on the nice warm door because they are on warm surfaces. You open your door. Your house presumably is heated to the power of 100 and it's even warmer inside than outside. So as a consequence, the fly comes into the heat and that's why it's coming in. So you have several choices. You can turn down the heat completely and have inside even more cold than the outside. You can turn your house around so it's facing north rather than east. Or you can pray for rain every day and then the fly won't come in. But that's why it's coming in. Otherwise, it could be coming in if there was smelly food, if it wanted to lay its eggs on some kind of decaying things. And patently, your house isn't smelly like that. So I'd put my money on your house is too hot, Derek.
I don't put the heat on in the morning, Aina.
Well, you must be hot stuff. But I mean, the house is actually sitting on the front door because the front door is warm, being heated up by the sun on the hot sunny morning. And then you open the door and, of course, there's more light inside. There's windows inside. The fly is disturbed by you opening the door and in it comes into a more space. God knows what it might find in there. It's on an exploratory mission and that's why it's coming in. So you'll have to get a fly screen or something or bang the door before you open it to make the fly jump off it so it won't open. Why are you opening the front door anyway? To see is the fly there?
No, I'm opening the front door to go out, to go to work.
I think she'll go out just after you. What are you doing running around the house after the fly?
No, because as soon as I open it, it comes in. I'm not kidding you. Yeah, the moment I open the door, it's in the door. And then I have to walk. No, I don't want it in there laying its eggs or anything else. Thank you very much indeed. Can't they lay up to 500 eggs in a lifetime, a female fly?
That's right, if it's going to do this. No, bang the door before you open it so the fly will jump off it and then scoot out and pull the door after you.
Anyway, listen, right now, another man who's out and about making observations on our behalf is Terry Flanagan. He's got his eye keenly fixed on nature. Where exactly are you, Terry, this evening?
I'm at Spencer Dock on the banks of the Royal Canal, just beside the Docklands train station, close to the Luke Kelly Memorial. I'm sure all of us remember poor Luke Kelly. He died in 1984. He was only 44 years of age. And there's this wonderful bust right behind me here. In fact, where I'm standing is a newly opened section of the Royal Canal Greenway, and it connects the Docklands with the North Strand, and it's wider than the rest of the canal. When I look up north, I can see the North Strand and the imposing Crow Park. And to the west is the Spire and O'Connell Street. But one thing I would say is there's plenty of wildlife here. Just before I arrived, or just as I arrived, a pair of herons came and they landed on the far side. And they're standing there about 100 metres apart, up to their ankles in water, not paying any piece of attention to me or anyone else that's walking by. They're just there fishing. I've got ducks swimming by. There's swallows over my head. But I've come to see something totally different.
What have you gone to see, Terry?
I've gone to see a species that's the bane of a lot of people's lives. And they're the gulls, or the seagulls. Now, I remember you used to call them seagulls, and Eric Dempsey corrected me once. He says, don't be calling them seagulls. They're not seagulls, they're gulls. And when I asked him, why are they not seagulls? And the answer is, and it's very good answers, because they can be found everywhere in Ireland, right into Athlone. Now, the gulls in question here are herring gulls, and they're present all the time. And I've come to watch a specific behaviour. No, not them feeding, not them mating, but to watch them bathing, of all things. Now, nearly all birds bathe. Think of the blackbirds and the starlings in your back garden, especially if you have a water feature. Gulls, they spend a lot of time in water, but they spend it in seawater, and this leads to salt in their plumage. And the amount of time and effort birds put into bathing, it shows us how critical feather maintenance is. Now, as I look out, I can see a small group of gulls have landed just about 100 metres away from me. And one or two always land first, then the rest seem to come in. And they seem to follow a routine. They land, they take a drink of water first, they duck the head under the water, they settle on the water, then another ducking of the head, then this flapping of the wings. And when all that's over, they follow it with preening. They need to force this surplus water from between their feathers to protect their insulating properties. Now, among them all, there's a lesser black-backed gull. Now, he's not joining in. He's just resting. He's taking no interest in what the others are doing. And what happens then is a small group have just landed very close to me here onto the edge, the stone edging of the canal. Remember, the canal is man-made, so the edging of the canal here is, I don't think it's granite, it's some other stone. And they show little interest in the locals. The locals are going about their business, they're walking up and down, and it gives us a great chance to study animal behaviour, in this case, the behaviour of these gulls. Now, people don't have to come down here to the Docklands to see this. I've seen it in many other places, in the park, in the Phoenix Park, along the Ordnance Survey Road, the quarry lake that's there. I think it's sometimes called the Island Lake. There's also a lake called the Machine Lake very close by. Don't ask me why it's called a Machine Lake, I haven't a clue. Also in Talla, I've seen it in the Sean Walsh Memorial Park. And I'm sure there's lots of similar small lakes and ponds around the country where this behaviour could be observed. I've got a question for Aina and for Niall. And that is, while I'm looking in here now, all of the gulls, bar one, are adult gulls. They're herring gulls. There's very few immature gulls. And the immature gulls that come in, I never ever see them preening. So I just wonder, do they behave differently or something?
Well, Terry, when it comes to the gulls all being adult, that is a very interesting observation. And what I suspect is happening, that these will be adults who are breeding at the moment. And so they're sort of associating with the colonies around the coast, or perhaps even on rooftops around the city. And so they're all sort of moving together, sort of safety in numbers, when they know that the chicks are safe and the weather conditions are just right. Whereas the juvenile birds, or the immature gulls that aren't fully adult yet, because it takes about 4 years for herring gulls to reach sexual maturity, they're not so tied to the areas near the nesting sites. They can travel much more widely because, of course, they're not having to come back to incubate eggs or to tend chicks. So they're free to go wherever they like. For these adult gulls who are breeding at the moment, they can't really go all that far. So they have to get the bathing done when they can. And it's very important for them to have their feathers in absolutely tip-top condition at the moment because, of course, those feathers are key to the insulating of the eggs when they're trying to incubate them. And any gaps or any dirt in those feathers would mean that the insulating properties would be spoiled and they wouldn't be quite so efficient. So the cleaner those birds can be, the better in terms of incubating their eggs and keeping their chicks warm. And of course, the salt water can also damage their feathers, as you said. So when they get a source of fresh water like this, they'll take advantage of it. And very often I've seen them, they really go for it. You know, they're really ruffling up their feathers. They're scrubbing away with their beaks. They really are. Like it's like watching somebody, you know, having a bath and splashing around in it, like bathing a toddler or something like that, because they do make quite a lot of splashing. And that's really to try and drive the water into the feathers to remove any salt and any dust and dirt and maybe parasites that are in there that would threaten their chicks. So that's why I think it's just the adults that you're seeing, because the juveniles, they're probably going off to other areas where they can bathe in a puddle. They don't have to be in big groups like that. And it's a bit safer for them to do that probably as well.
I was going to ask about herring gulls are coming inland more and more because of the way we are overfishing the seas and there's more territory for them to nest. But like long ago, herring gulls were called herring gulls and seagulls because they were at sea. And there must have been lots of gulls living on islands with no fresh water that would have had no access to fresh water. So do herring gulls need fresh water to bathe? What happens if you're only at sea in a sea situation and you don't have fresh water? Are you at a disadvantage if you're that sort of a situation where you're living?
Well, they don't absolutely need to have fresh water, but it's a big advantage for them if they do. So they can survive perfectly well with just salt water. They have a special organ that allows them to excrete it. So they can drink salt water. They're taking on obviously a lot of seawater in their diet and they can excrete that without causing them any harm. And if need be, you can bathe in salt water. It might shorten the lifespan of their feathers. It does have a corrosive effect, but it would at least keep them clean. But what they tend to do in those situations is that they use rainwater. So if there's a heavy rainstorm, you'll see the gulls then sometimes just standing there as though they're in the shower rather than the bath. And they're ruffling up their feathers in the same way. They're preening deeply with their beak to get those feathers opened up so they can get the rainwater in there. So they like storms for that reason. So you can sometimes see that at nesting colonies on islands around the coast where the gulls don't want to leave the nests because in a heavy rain, of course, their eggs could be chilled. So they're staying there. They do sit down, but they will still use that water to wash themselves. That's one of the ways that they would do it. Obviously, when you see the gulls moving into the city and inland, people talk about this a lot in Dublin. But of course, Dublin isn't inland. Dublin is a coastal city. And I think you can, you know, take it for granted that gulls have for millennia have come up rivers into urban areas. It's certainly since the founding of Dublin over 1,000 years ago, there have been gulls around the city.
Yeah, but it seems like there are a lot more now in the last few years than there ever have been. And people are not happy about it.
Well, part of it's perception.
There's a big hoo-ha going on.
There certainly is. People's perception can be a bit biased when it comes to this. You certainly, in the winter months, you see more gulls around the urban areas than you actually do in the summer. We get a much bigger influx of gulls in the winter. They tend to be more along the coastal areas, but you regularly see them along the Liffey. What's happening at the moment that's bringing them into conflict with people is their propensity now to nest on top of rooftops,
yes.
Particularly the herring gulls and the lesser blackback gulls.
Man-made cliffs.
Yeah, precisely. As far as the birds are concerned, they may as well be islands. They like to nest on secure islands and a high building surrounded by traffic and roads that's very secure
and
from predators.
June, July and August is the breeding season.
That's
so
exactly
they're getting
it.
Ready. I've seen a lot of birds, a lot of gulls actually, herring gulls in particular, which is Terry is talking about in Stephen's Green, gathering up nesting material.
That's what they do. Yes, absolutely. So when you see a bird carrying sticks or bits of grass or whatever, dry grass, that's a clear sign that they're building a nest because there'd be no reason for them to do that otherwise. They're not eating it. Now, we have seen in recent years an increase in gulls nesting on rooftops. Not an increase in gulls around urban areas. Dublin has always had a huge population of gulls. But nesting on rooftops, yes, that's becoming an increasing phenomenon.
But let me tell you, Niall, when I go for my little walk and because we're all eating and socialising outdoors and I sit in the park and I have a sandwich in front of me, a cup of tea, they are very cheeky and they really hassle you for a bit of your sandwich. The pigeons get the message pretty quickly. You could give a pigeon a dirty look and it's gone. But the gulls stay there and they keep coming at you. And in some cases, they come flying and taking it. They come over your shoulder. It kind of behind you, attack you, take the... Should we just not cull them, get rid of them?
Well,
because that's what a lot of people want.
Oh, I understand they want it, but we absolutely shouldn't. We should bear in mind, of course, that this is a protected species under Irish and EU law, and it's not the fact that their population has increased. In fact, it has decreased. The population of herring gulls in Ireland went down by 90% over the course of just 30 years.
Well, it's hard to believe.
Well, that's the thing. That's why we have scientific evidence to back all this up, because people's own anecdotal observations would be misleading in many cases, because people are seeing them more coming into parks, they're seeing them more coming into urban areas and onto rooftops. And it's really a sign of a species in crisis, not a species that's doing well and thriving. What's happened is, in terms of the breeding, first of all, many of the offshore islands around Dublin Bay, and indeed at other sites around Ireland where they would normally nest, have become overrun with introduced non-native predators. So things like brown rats, American mink. Also problems with a lot of people going out there. There's a lot, if you go somewhere like Ireland's Eye, for example, big gull colony out there, but you'll see lots of day trippers just walking blithely through that colony. The gulls are swooping and panicking. And eventually some of them think, why am I nesting here? It's not safe anymore. I'd be much better off nesting on one of those big tall buildings in the city where there aren't any human beings, because they're not up on the roofs and so forth. It's much safer.
Yeah, but Niall, cut to the chase. It's my sandwich.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be harassed by the gulls.
I understand that completely, nor do I when I'm there. It's only a few of the gulls that do that.
So what do we do?
Most gulls haven't learned that bad behaviour. I think the most important
thing... You must be joking. They're all at it.
I'm not joking
at
all.
When is the last time you sat in the park?
They're not, but they're not
all at it. With a sandwich in your hand or an ice cream.
But the ones that you see in the park, Derek, might be at it, but they're not the majority of the population. That's just a few of the rogue ones that have come in. And of course, they have learned this bad behaviour because of human bad behaviour.
Okay, so what do we do?
Well, first, the most important thing of all is to stop feeding gulls. It's very important that people don't throw them their chips or the end of their sandwiches so they don't learn to associate human beings with food. That's very important. You mentioned about the pigeons, obviously, that they'll back down and the gulls necessarily or won't necessarily do so. Well, if you look at the difference between a pigeon and a gull, what's a pigeon going to do to you if you try something? It's not going to be able to defend itself. Gulls themselves, they're a bit stronger, and they realise sometimes that they can get their way through brute force. So that's important. But I think we need to look at the gulls being in the urban areas not as the problem itself. It's a symptom of a much wider problem. And that problem is the collapse of the marine ecosystems. As Aina said, problems with overfishing. Climate change is also affecting the marine environment and their ability to feed. We need to make sure that their nesting colonies on the islands where they've nested for centuries around the Dublin Bay and elsewhere, that they are protected during the summer breeding season so that the birds aren't being disturbed.
So Birdwatch Ireland, you personally and Birdwatch Ireland would not be in favour of any kind of cull?
Absolutely not. We would in fact very much oppose it, and it would be contrary to any kind of to the law both here in Ireland and to EU law as well. So it would be actually a
So would you be ready for a fisticuffs with any organisations that would attempt? Would you really?
Not personally, I'm not going to actually fight anybody.
Well,
but
illegal
fisticuffs,
whatever you call it.
We are involved in this. We've been in discussions with the European Commission about this because it's an issue. We need to make sure that they're properly protected. But I understand people's frustration. I really do. I mean, it's not something people want to see. The problem with the birds nesting on the roofs and taking food, they are two completely separate issues, though. When birds become territorial from nesting on the roofs, that's because they're trying to protect their eggs and their chicks the same as they would on a nesting island. Those birds aren't necessarily being attracted in for food. That's because of a lack of nesting sites that are secure. The food one's a different issue. That happens year round. It's not just in the summer. The breeding behaviour is only in the summer.
It's very noticeable in the summer, and it's more noticeable now because people are socialising outside.
Of course, but
that's the reason we're really seeing it.
The reason it's more noticeable in the summer is because people are more likely to be outside eating in the summer.
Well, okay, have you any suggestions on how I can deter gulls from wanting my sandwich when they're there?
Well, one thing that has been shown to work, a lot of work research has been done in Cornwall, in England particularly, because it's long been a problem there, probably more so than anywhere in Ireland. And scientists have found that if you make eye contact with that gull, it's much less likely to approach. They like to sneak in, they don't like to take unnecessary risks. So if you eyeball it and just stare it down, it usually backs away. So that's what I'd recommend. Eyeball the gull. Just sit down, maybe, you know, if you can find a bench with where you have a back to the wall or to a tree or something like that. And then if the gulls are approaching, if you stare at them, they'll think, oh, I've been rumbled here. This is a bit risky. I'll just go somewhere else. So I would say eyeball the gull. Them down.
That'll Terry, work. Eyeball the gulls. Have you got that?
Yeah, I'm eyeballing the gulls here. And I must say, there's nobody down here with a sandwich. And if you really want to get close to gulls, and if you really want to watch them and to observe their behaviour, they're really a very, very pleasant bird. You can get very, very close to them, and they don't give a damn what you're doing. So people who want to see gulls in a nicer light, in a better light, get down to the Spencer Dock where I am here, and I guarantee you, you'll enjoy them.
Terry, thank you very much indeed. It's time to say hello now to Dr. Richard Collins, who's in Malahide. Hello, Richard, how are you?
Hello, Derek. Can you hear me clearly?
We can hear you very clearly.
Far away.
We're only in Malahide, for heaven's sake. What number bus goes to Malahide? Is it the 42 or something?
Well, the one that passes my door is the 32, but the 42 also comes.
Oh,
yes.
I knew it was something like that. Just before I ask you a couple of questions, Niall, you have been checking which direction my house is facing during the commercial break.
Aina was spot on. Your front door does indeed face east.
Well done, Aina Nealana. Congratulations. Cohorticus.
I'm no slouch, Derek.
Well done. Anyway, Richard, I have a question for you this morning. I was out and about in Marley Park, and can I I just say to the people who manage Marley Park, I think it's Dunleary Rathdown County Council, fantastic, spectacular, really clean, beautiful. Anyway, somebody was asking me about how I can distinguish between the sexes of the birds, the ducks and all this kind of stuff, because they all look the same. Well, I pointed out some mallard and I said, that's a female, she's brown. There's a drake, well, actually four or five drakes hanging out of the female, and they are very different, very flamboyant and all that. But he said, what about the swans? And I said, well, that's a little bit more difficult. They've got a big knob on their nose, on the top of their beak. I think it's called a basal knob, is it not, if I'm not mistaken?
Yes.
Richard knows all about this. And I said, in the male, I think it's bigger than the female. And he said, well, what about these guys? And he pointed at the coots. And I said, well, then that's where it gets complicated. I said, there's something called a cloaca, and you have to kind of turn the bird upside down and blow on it like that, and then you reveal the cloaca, and everything happens in that. But I said, I don't know how it, and I don't know, I still wouldn't be able to do it. I'm not a Richard, can you explain?
Derek, go to the Forum in Rome, and the great drain that runs down the centre of the Forum is called the Cloaca Maxima, the drain of ancient Rome. And now, of course, the cloaca has been taken up medically to mean the back passage. So the birds have only one passage. They don't have a separate one for birth and a separate one for urine and a separate one for feces. They have to keep the number of pipes to a minimum. They have to be lice to fly. So they amalgamate them all into one. And there's one opening. And that's the two, the male and the female, must bring these openings together to transfer the sperm.
A little now, kiss, a cloacal kiss or something like that, isn't it?
Yes, a very brief thing. The problem for birds is that they want to fly. And you can't have things dangling out of you if you are flying. They impede your movement through the air.
Sure they do.
So to streamline them, they don't have penises dangling out of them and scroti and things of that kind. And they're beautifully streamlined. So you have to bring the two together. Now, water birds have a bit of a problem. You take swans, for instance. Swans must mate on the water. They mate on the water. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with cloacal kisses on water is that the sperm can be washed away and the system will break down. So swans, curiously enough, have a penile organ. It's not the same as a mammoth's penis, but they have this thing tucked inside the cloaca, which erects so that when the male mounts, he's able to bring his penis into contact with the female's cloaca and transfer the sperm. And when we come to sex swans, for instance, yes, you mentioned the berry, the black knob. The black knob is usually more prominent in the male than in the female, but you will often see pairs where you couldn't really tell the difference. And I've seen one or two pairs where the female had the big black berry, a bigger black berry than her partner.
Oh, now hang on a second. Now, how did you know it was the female?
Me? You may be, oh, there's no problem. Because once the nesting gets underway, she does all the work. She sits for 36 days on those eggs. And he does the patrolling. He's in charge of security. She's in charge of the domestic business. It's a labour-divided society. And that's the way they work it. So you can tell immediately who's who. But you could be fooled when you come first. Now, when I catch them, I turn the bird over. It's not the most dignified of postures, and there's a trick. There are various tricks in doing it. And then you expose the cloaca, and there is a way of manipulating the cloaca in a male such that if there is a penis, it will pop out. If there isn't a penis, of course, it won't pop out. So that is the definitive way to tell whether you're dealing with
a male. Can I just say, we're not suggesting that anybody does this at home. It was just a question I happened to be asked while I was in Marley Park this morning, and I could only go so far with the answer, but I knew you guys would definitely be able to give it chapter and verse. Okay, so but basically, you know, that is how you distinguish the male from the female, by examining the cloaca.
Yes, well, in the swamp.
Or going to Rome.
Rome is the great source of
congratulations to Italy. They won the Eurovision Song Contest last night, by the way. It'll probably be Italy, the Eurovision
Italians,
last night.
Apparently, yes, they did. I didn't see the contest, but well done to the Italians. They were always great musicians. Music, all the musical terms are Italian, remember? And they started it off, and Italian music is wonderful, and it's so varied. You know, it hasn't got the gloom and doom of German music. Beautiful and all is German.
Right. I don't
don't start an international incident, Richard. Thanks very much. There are indeed. Now, we have been asking you to send your wildlife observations, questions and such via WhatsApp to 087-708-7031. And one of our listeners has done, well, actually several have, but we've got one now we want you to have a listen to. And we will hope to do this every Sunday on the programme while we're here live for the next 8 weeks or thereabouts. So have a listen to this one, please.
Hello, Derek. My name is Susan Middleton. I'm calling you from County Wexford. Quick observation question for Niall, please. We have a woodpecker that's been visiting us for the last 3 weeks, coming onto the bird nut feeder. And I've never seen one before in my life. And I just wanted to know, is this a common thing now? I'd really like to know, because I love having him visit us, and I've never seen it before. Thanks a million. Bye.
Well, that's a very good question, and it is becoming increasingly reported that people are having woodpeckers coming to their feeders in their gardens. In this case, it's the great spotted woodpecker, which is a species that only colonised Ireland around 2005. So they've only been with us for a decade and a half, more or less. And we know that what happened was this species is very common across the water in Britain and indeed across the whole continent, but was absent from Ireland. But it seems the population in Britain reached such a high level that some of the juvenile birds there had no hope of finding their own territory, and they flew across the Irish Sea from Wales. And simultaneously, it seems, went across from Scotland into County Down. So Wicklow was colonised in the Republic of Ireland, County Down, Northern Ireland. And since then, over the last decade and a half, they have been spreading. We now know that there's certainly over 100 pairs of them nesting in Ireland, maybe more. And as, of course, they're breeding, they're producing young, they're going to spread out more and more. It's no coincidence that you're in Wexford, because that is obviously right beside Wicklow, and the species has been colonising southwards from Wicklow into Wexford. And from that point of view, you will start to see them there. But we're having breeding records this year in Kilkenny. Quite a few people saying, feeders there. There's been reports then even from Galway, so they really are spreading, and even into Cork. So it looks like the species is here to stay, and as it expands and the population builds, we will see more of them come to feeders.
And in case you're wondering, you couldn't make any mistaking that it's a woodpecker hanging on your hanging feeder, because they are big birds in relation to anything else that's going to turn up at that hanging feeder, and yes, they're much more colourful.
They are. So when you see birds on hanging feeders, normally you're thinking of the small or medium sized birds like blue tits or green finches or birds like that. So certainly the great spotted woodpecker, it's roughly the size of a blackbird, so a large bird to be hanging on a feeder.
But thinner.
It is thinner and has a different shape completely. They have a sort of a very pointed tail, sort of spikes on the bottom of it. They use that to sort of use as a prop to hold themselves up there. And they're very strongly black and white with a flash of red just underneath
very
the
prominent
tail. And the back of the head on the male has a flash of red. Yeah. So if you see one with just has black and white on the head, it's a female. The male has red on the back. And the young have totally red on top of their head.
And you know what they look like?
What's that?
Woodpeckers. Richard, do you want to say something about this?
Yes. Niall mentioned the red on the head. Now, there is an illustration in the Book of Kells of a woodpecker type bird, and it has a little red on its head. So the monks back in 8800 or thereabouts, they seem to have known their birds, at least some of them now. The other factor here, I think, on the bird table is the woodpecker is a skilled negotiator of things like bird tables. I notice when jackdaws and blackbirds occasionally go to my bird table, they seem insecure. They're not happy doing it. We don't have woodpeckers where I am, but a woodpecker is able to hang on. He's got that hind claw. He's able to he's at home doing that, and he's used to going in. And if you were a cover on your bird table, he'd still manage to get in and out. It is no problem to a woodpecker. That's his trade, to get at things, and he's good at poking insects out of holes and all kinds of things. So it's not such a big transition from his natural feeding environment to a bird table.
Richard, what do you know about doves, the bird?
Doves? Well, doves and pigeons are the same creature. There's no distinction to be drawn between them. But we use the word dove for small pigeons. And, of course, the rural pigeon is descended from the rock dove, a dove that lives in sea cliffs mainly. You can still see what appear to be pure rock doves on the cliffs around Ireland. Why do you ask about doves, Justin?
Well, you're going to discover in a moment, but where did the pure white doves come from, or do you know, or am I just throwing that sidewinder at you? Can you answer that?
They would be artificially bred tumbler pigeons. Once these creatures were domesticated, see, pigeons were very useful. They were the post office. They were telecommunications long ago. You couldn't send messages over long distances quickly except by attaching them to the legs of doves and letting the doves off. They say that on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, for instance, 5,000 doves were released, carrying messages from the front to the officers back at headquarters, delineating how the battle was going. Now, prior to that, they were already kept as food dovecotes. If you go to the old castles in Ireland, some of them still have extant dovecotes, and they raised doves then. Well, now, what happens then, of course, is that people start breeding them, breeding characteristics, breeding them for pigeon raising, breeding them for exotic plumages, and so on and so forth. So you have a whole profusion of lovely coloured doves now, and you have shows and things where they are. And Darwin, of course, used this. He saw artificial selection being responsible for the great profusion of doves. So he was inclined to say, oh, well, perhaps nature does the same thing and breeds different types of species depending on the forces of selection there. So that is very interesting. Now, of course, the most famous dove of all was one you and I will never see, alas.
The dodo.
Dodo, dead as the dodo. There was another one, the Rodriguez solitaire on Réunion. Mm-hmm. So doves are a very interesting lot.
So basically, the pure white doves are just bred to be pure white, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, well, of course, they were
You did drive around the park there. But anyway, so why are they so universally accepted as symbols of peace now?
I think it's because of their gentle nature and because they're so faithful as pairs to each other. So you'll see them having this pair bond, which for many in domesticity as well, it lasts for life. So they seem to be very faithful to each other. And this is something that people noted early on when they were domesticating these birds. They saw that they were very faithful. And a lot of it also comes from a wild species called the turtle dove, which is only a very rare visitor to Ireland. But it's traditionally quite widespread on the continent and in parts of southern England, although in real trouble at the moment because of illegal hunting in the Mediterranean. But that was seen very much as a present that you would give to an engaged couple to show, because it symbolised fidelity. Mm. The two would be preening each other in the cage, had a beautiful bird to look at as well. So that seems to be where it originated. But there's a long history of people keeping doves in captivity, selectively breeding them, as Richard said. These mutations arise, people like, a random white dove appeared, they can propagate that line, and all of a sudden you have this whole diversity of different forms that Darwin actually, he thought that they were all must have derived from different species. And what actually seems to have sparked, or been a major spark at least for his whole theory about the evolution by natural selection, was that when these doves in captivity of many different types that look wildly different from each other, when they interbred, after a few generations, the offspring reverted to look very much like the wild rock dove. And a light bulb went off in his head and he realised, they look very different, but actually centuries of artificial selection from selectively breeding rock doves has produced all these wonderful different forms. And well, maybe nature works in the same way through natural selection. That seems to spark the whole thing. And what I love about is his seminal work on the origin of species. Everyone assumes that there must be loads in there about the Galapagos Islands and the Galapagos finches. And there is a bit way through the book when you read it. But the first few chapters are all about pigeons. He was an absolute pigeon nut. So I think, it's a really fascinating bird from that point of view too.
Well, the reason I went back to your comment about the weddings has to do with our next guest. His name is Joe Freely. And for the past 3 years, he's been breeding and training doves for weddings and funerals and bar mitzvahs or whatever happened yourself. Anyway, we'll say hello to him now and he can tell us all about himself. Hello, Joe. So the conch, as they say, is yours. Tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Hi, Joe Freely is my name. I'm from Ballyhaunis in County Mayo. I'm retired for the last 3 years and I've always had an interest in birds, and I decided that I wasn't going to spend my retirement sitting in front of a television set watching soaps or Netflix. So I decided to get into training birds, and I got into training doves, and that's what I do today. And a very good friend of mine, Anthony Bracken in Dublin, who he and his dad raised pigeons for years, pointed me in the right direction. Now, I hadn't a clue about pigeons or doves. So I got six and I started training them. He told me how to train them. Next thing, when I put a few photographs up on Facebook, a few friends contacted me. They wanted to use them for weddings, for funerals, for birthday parties, and even divorce parties. At this stage, 3 years later, I have about 50 birds. As I say, I breed them all. But one of my young birds, on its first day out training, was attacked by a sparrowhawk. I brought it into the vet. And the vet tried to patch it up. He couldn't stitch it. He put some antiseptic on its back and he said, I think it might be better to put it down. But I said, no way am I doing that. So I brought it into the house, hand-fed it, reared it. And in a few months, it became my best pal. Yeah, it actually ended up sleeping on my pillow every night. But not to deny it the freedom, I would let it out every morning, flying with the rest of my birds. But when it came to feeding time, this bird would not go back into the loft. She insisted on sitting outside the back door and coming into my house to be fed. So that's exactly how we became so friendly. But unfortunately, probably the fact that she wasn't aware of any dangers, a neighbour's cat happened to get her about 2 months ago. And I'm not ashamed to say, Derek, I cried for the full day because I lost an absolutely brilliant and beautiful friend.
Well, Joe, that's a sad story. I've so many questions for you, but the first thing I suppose is I always thought that birds slept standing up. Now, you're saying it slept on the pillow beside you. How did it actually sleep beside you?
Oh, it actually stood on the pillow and pooed every now and again in my face.
And when you got them first, how big were they? How old were they?
5 weeks. And that's when you start training these birds. You let them out into the aviary and they have a look at their surroundings and they begin to look around and see where they are. The following week, you let them out totally and they fly up onto the roof and they won't go any further. And then the next week, I bring them with their parents and go a half a mile away from my house and release them. But this has to be done. Every time you release these birds when you're training, it has to be done from the four major points of the compass, north, south, east and west. So over 5 months, you graduate up to, which I have now done, 200 miles. As I said, I'm here in Clonmel at the moment and I'm releasing birds at a funeral and they'll be home before me.
Have you ever lost any?
Oh, I have. Yes, of course, I have lost. The sparrowhawk, peregrine falcon and the domestic cat is probably the biggest culprit of the lot.
But none of them have ever lost their way home, which is really what I meant.
Oh, no. They've either been injured or... And all my birds are tagged. So if they actually are attacked and they're found by people, they can look at the tag straight away and contact the Irish Homing Union and they know exactly who that bird belongs to. But I've been very, very fortunate. The whole secret is to take it easy. Don't rush these birds. You've got to give them confidence.
They've got to trust you. They've got to believe in you. And they've got to become your friends. You're their master as well, though.
Exactly. And I mean, I never envisaged getting into this as the way I've got into it. But it's my passion. And all these birds are my babies.
Well, it's a very interesting career choice. What did you do before you retired, Joe, if you don't mind me asking you?
Oh, I had a very checkered career. I was in the hotel industry for many a year. I was the youngest hotel manager that Jury's Hotel ever had. And then I went into my parents' business in Ballyhaunis. And then I went into the radio business. No, not broadcasting, but I was accounts manager for the radio, Midwest Radio.
And now, how would you describe yourself now? What's your occupation today?
My occupation today is a pastime and a passion. Full stop. If I never got a booking to come down here, like I'm here today in Clonmel, I'm in Kilkenny tomorrow for another funeral, sadly. But it just keeps me occupied. It keeps me from sitting in front of a television screen, getting old.
Nobody wants to get old. But do you have a job description? Would you be a dove wrangler or something like that?
When I had to register my van, I had to put it down as an animal trainer.
And did you have to get a special license and all that kind of stuff for that?
No. Like, but when you get a commercial license, you have to state what your occupation is. And they didn't have a dove trainer on the list, so I had to go to the nearest thing, which is an animal trainer.
Now, I'm assuming your doves are pure white, are they?
Absolutely. They're all from the Logan breed. It's a breed of doves. And I also have Indian fantails. Now, the Indian fantails are really only for display. They aren't capable of homing. So if I release those here now today in Clonmel, they would not make their way back to Ballyhonus. They just don't have that homing instinct. I display them all in cages at a wedding or at a funeral and for people to take photographs, but I only release the Logans.
Well, Joe, we've got Niall Hatch here, and you know, I'm sure you're aware of Niall. He's
one
of our regular panelists,
yes,
but he's also the
Public Relations
and Development Officer with Birdwatch Ireland. Are you a Dove fan, Niall?
I am, absolutely, Derek. I love all members of the dove and pigeon family. There's something really special about them. I know some people grumble about the wood pigeons in their garden or the feral pigeons on the city streets, but there is something that I find is really endearing about them. They're a really special group of birds. And I've seen different species of pigeon and dove all over the world. Just to say, you can use those terms interchangeably. There's no real biological difference between a pigeon and a dove. It's just usually the smaller ones or the pale-coloured ones or the more gentle-looking ones that we tend to call doves and the larger, fatter, stouter ones we tend to call pigeons, but there's no biological distinction. Many people would use both terms for them. Some people would call one a pigeon, someone would call it a dove, so it doesn't really make much difference. But they really are a charming group of birds, and I think they're really underappreciated. So it's great to hear from Joe and his real love and affection that he has for doves. It's really infectious itself, I must say.
One of the first concerns I ever get and the first question I get from people that would contact me is, what happens to the birds after you release them? Now, if these birds aren't trained properly, they will not survive. They will not make their way home. That's why I've said to you, it takes a minimum of 5 months to train these properly. I could train them for further distance, but I have mine trained to return home from a distance of 200 miles as the crow flies in a straight line. So I know that if anything happens to them, it's not my fault. It's probably through nature. Sparrowhawks, peregrine falcons, you name it, but they have to be trained properly. And I know a lot of people have concerns, you know, because you hear these horror stories about people letting these birds off and, you know, they're not trained. And they won't survive. They won't get back home to where they're from.
Niall, what about that idea of the dove becoming Joe's very best friend?
I think that's really lovely, and it's a really, really touching story. And I think that doves have long been a symbol of peace and love. And a big reason for that is that because they're very faithful as a pair. So you'll see that the male and the female staying together, even outside the breeding season, they preen each other. It almost looks like they're kissing, this aloe preening, we call it, where they do that to strengthen the bond. So it seems that with doves, it's very important to have a bond with a flock mate or with a mate in the true sense, like that. And I suppose what happened in this case was, Joe, that this lovely dove came to see you as its mate. And certainly you were very tolerant. You were allowing it to poop on your face when you're asleep. And that certainly is love on your part as well, I think. So there was two of you in it.
Oh, yeah. She was just beautiful. And she was called Sue. I called her Sue. And the reason why I called her Sue was because of the first two letters of the word survived. And she did survive, but unfortunately not after the first year. But I now have another bird that was kicked out of the nest, and I've called her Houdini.
Well, let's hope she doesn't escape on you. Well, Joe, it was lovely to speak with you today. Thank you very much indeed for bringing that story to us. It's enlightened us and has kind of warmed my heart, I have to say.
Yeah, really charming. Really lovely.
It is. Joe, the very best of luck. Keep in touch. Thanks very much indeed, Joe. Bye.
I will indeed. Thanks, Derek. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Now, where are we going to next? Ken Whelan, our fishery scientist, has popped in. We're going to be talking to him in just a moment about the relationship between fish eyes and what they've been eating. But first, Ken, any idea what the fastest fish in the oceans is?
I knew you were going to stick me with this.
Come on, Ken.
From memory. I think it's probably the sailfish, and I think they do about 100 kilometres per hour, 60, 70 miles an hour.
Wow.
Fabulous creatures. Let me tell you the most extraordinary thing about sailfish, which people don't really appreciate.
Well, before you tell us that, will you describe what it looks like first?
Absolutely. So the sailfish is one of the billfish, so it has a great big pointed beak at the front, mm-hmm. and it has a beautiful sail that goes almost the full length of the dorsal fin. And it's extraordinarily high when you lift up the fin. You know, you're looking at several feet high, the fin. But the most extraordinary thing about that fin is, and I was privileged many years ago to do some tagging in Africa, and we were bringing the fish into the side of the boat to put some little tags in their back. And I could not get over the sound of the fin in the wave. It's made of a material that must be very similar to canvas. And what I wasn't expecting was the flapping of the sail. It was the most extraordinary thing, and I'll never, ever forget it as long as I live. And it's not something that you ever hear mentioned.
Have you ever seen one, Niall?
I haven't. I'd love to. Very impressive fish, absolutely. But nope, I haven't been lucky enough.
And they can jump just so, so high. They are fantastic creatures. They really are. And the other thing is, when we were bringing them on board, the crew were so nervous of that bill because they had seen it do some serious damage to people that weren't careful. It's really, really, really
rough.
And
why were you tagging them?
Well, what was happening was we weren't actually sport fishing. But at that stage, which was about 15 years ago or more, the group that we were with were trying to promote a situation whereby none of the fish that were caught were actually harvested. So they started to tag the billfish. And in fact, a marlin that my brother caught and tagged ended up being caught again. And they got fantastic information about the migratory pattern of the fish. We were in Kenya, and there were certain areas in Somalia and so on north of us where there was quite a big harvest and they were losing a lot of fish. But it was interesting, they did get some tags back. So it gave them a great idea as to how these species might be managed.
So the speed again, just to remind everybody, this is something that's going to come up on one of these table quizzes in some future days.
You can blame me if it's wrong.
Come on.
I think it's about 100 kilometres an hour. I think it's 60 to 70 miles an hour is what they were clocked at.
So the sailfish is the fastest fish in the ocean.
A sailfish is the fastest fish in the ocean, and I can be sacked if I'm wrong.
All right. Ken Whelan is here, our fisheries expert, as I said. And Ken, I mentioned that you know by looking into a fish eye what that fish has eaten. Come on, you're making it up.
Well, yes, the eyes definitely have it this evening. Let me explain to you what we're about. And this is all down to my very brilliant colleagues in the US and now in the UK as well. So I have talked on numerous occasions on the programme about fish scales and about fish ear stones and the clever things we could do in saying how the fish grew and the age of the fish. Then we went a step further and we started to take little samples out of these and we could look genetically at the fish. But now what they're doing is we have a situation with salmon where very large numbers die after spawning quite naturally. So colleagues of mine are actually collecting the bodies of these fish and collecting the eyes out of the bodies of these salmon. And using a very fine forceps, they're able to peel back the layers in the eye, just like a tiny, tiny onion. And each layer is telling them a story in terms of what the fish has been feeding on and where. And it's all down to the whole idea of what we call chemical isotopes. So the atoms that are in our body, whether it's nitrogen or carbon, come in different forms. And there are forms that we called isotopes. They're very stable. They're not the radioactive isotopes you hear about in terms of Chernobyl. They're really stable. But the pattern of isotopes that you find in particular food items is very steady. And they can actually tell then, hopefully, where the fish have been by way of analysing the actual eyes of the fish and seeing what has been laid down through their food. And they're beginning to actually build maps in terms of the actual areas in the ocean where the fish are feeding. All a bit loose at the moment, but every year that goes by, it's becoming more and more accurate. And I'm glad to say that now the Marine Institute in Ireland and many of my colleagues in the UK are working on a fairly major programme to see can we start using this technology as well.
And what's the purpose of using it? What will you find out and what will it tell you? How will you help the salmon?
Well, what we will find out is we've spoken on the programme on numerous occasions about the way climate change is directly impacting the migration and the feeding of these fish at sea. They live very, very high in the water. They live near the top of the ocean. They live within maybe 30 centimetres of the ocean as young fish. So everything that's happening by way of climate change is affecting these fish. And we think that it is changing currents and we think that it is changing the actual food that's available to them. So what we're hoping to be able to see are areas where there may be a change in terms of the food composition, because we have some idea as to what they were feeding on in the past. And if there's a change in diet, hopefully they'll be able to pick this up by looking at the layers in the eyes of fish. I know it sounds really space age and it sounds over the top, but I think it's a really exciting breakthrough.
Well, what do you expect salmon to be eating normally?
Well, it's interesting because people look on them as sort of majestic creatures that are going to eat very delicately. These creatures start off eating plankton in the ocean, but as quickly as they can, they become silver pike and they feed on fish. And predominantly they're feeding on a fish called capelin up around, say, Greenland. They feed on squid. But these are big, big silver predators. So they're looking opportunistically for any fish that they can find in the surface layers of the ocean.
Aina.
Yeah, so these fish, Ken, that they're feeding the capelin and the squid, have they different isotopes per species? So you would have capelin isotope, which would be different to squid isotope. And, you know, will they then be in the layers in the eyes? It certainly gives a different reading to keeping your eyes peeled, that's for sure.
Well, trust you, Aina. Yes, no, that's exactly it. Also, obviously, in terms of the actual chemical composition of the bodies themselves, in terms of the elements that they're including in the body structure. So as well as what they're eating, also the other components that are helping to build up the body, they're hoping to be able to build maps. But really, it's open season at the moment. And you'll be aware that, quite recently, there was a huge interest in microchemistry. So in addition to the isotopes themselves, they can also look at the chemicals that are in the ocean that are much more prevalent in the ocean than freshwater. And something we looked at relatively recently was the element strontium. So if you get a lot of strontium in a scale, you can be fairly sure that fish has spent some time in the estuary or the ocean. So it's fantastic. It's real detective work that my colleagues are about at the moment.
And will they change fish? I mean, they're eating capelin, but I mean, if climate change causes the capelin not to be in the water, then will they change to a different species completely?
Well, it's not just that, because at times we know it can be even more dramatic in the sense that because of the change in currents, when the fish go out at a relatively small size, they may end up accidentally in the wrong location. So if they end up in the wrong location, they may actually start absorbing in chemicals into their eyes from the natural food that they're finding, which is quite different to the food that they might have been feeding on in the 20s, 30s, 40s and so on. So you can see some real changes as a result of these chemical analyses.
Ken, is there a hierarchy of food for salmon? In our case, human case, some parts of the world have very great food resources, very good food. In other parts of the world, it's much more subsistence and so forth. Is it like that in the world of salmon? Can you say that they are in leaner times now than they were long ago?
Yeah, well, I think, indirectly, I think that's probably true in that when you think of the very small fish that are going out, no more than maybe 12 or 15 centimetres, they're carried along by these massive great currents. They're very active within the currents. So they don't really have a lot of choice in terms of where they initially end up. And it's around 750 grams to a kilo that they become masters of the ocean. And then they can forage and move around at will. But until that, they're fairly constrained. And that could be the key, because in that area where they're constrained, if we can actually find a consistent pattern in years when their migration is actually very accurate and where the currents are moving as they have in the past, then we can get a baseline. And if we see a deviation from that and suddenly it seems as if they're feeding off the north coast of Iceland, we know that the currents have gone wrong. And that's the hope. This is all very much speculation at the moment, but isn't it fun to speculate?
It certainly is. Ken, thank you very much indeed for coming in. You can learn more about it by visiting the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Very quickly, Niall, a text message has come in. Can buzzards kill baby lambs? Now, I think I told you I was travelling up Northern Ireland a couple of weeks ago, and there were lots of buzzards in the sky.
Yes, I saw lots out today. Nice warm day, so the buzzards are using the thermals, the rising warm air to fly. So just to be absolutely categorical about this, buzzards buzzards cannot and will not kill baby lambs. They will sometimes feed on dead lambs or on stillborn lambs, but they're no threat whatsoever to livestock. We're absolutely certain about that. They're in fact a real benefit because they kill rats and rabbits and young crows as well. So the farmer's friend, we always call them.
The farmer's friend indeed. My thanks to Niall Hatch, Aidan Ilana, Richard Collins and Terry Flanagan, and indeed all of our contributors. Our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly, our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland, and today's producer, Anna Leddy. Don't forget, you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next time, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.